Chapter 3. The Galapagos of the Periodic Table. Arsenic, gallium, cerium, yttrium, ytterbium, erbium, terbium. You might say the history of the periodic table is the history of the many characters who shaped it. The first had one of those names from history books, like Dr. Guillotine, or Charles Ponzi, or Jules Léotard, or Étienne de Silhouette, that makes you smile to think that someone actually answered to it. This pioneer of the periodic table deserves special praise, since his eponymous burner has enabled more sophomoric stunts than any lab equipment in history. Disappointingly, German chemist Robert Bunsen didn't actually invent his burner, just improved the design and popularized it in the mid-1800s. Even without the Bunsen burner, he managed to pack plenty of danger and destruction into his life. Bunsen's first love was arsenic. Although Element 33 has had quite a reputation since ancient times, Roman assassins used to smear it on figs, few law-abiding chemists knew much about arsenic before Bunsen started sloshing it around in test tubes. He worked primarily with arsenic-based cacodyls, chemicals whose name is based on the Greek word for stinky. Cacodyls smelled so foul, Bunsen said, they made him hallucinate, producing instantaneous tingling of the hands and feet, even giddiness and insensibility. His tongue became covered with a black coating. Perhaps from self-interest, he soon developed what's still the best antidote to arsenic poisoning, iron oxide hydrate, a chemical related to rust that clamps onto arsenic in the blood and drags it out. Still, he couldn't shield himself from every danger. The careless explosion of a glass beaker of arsenic nearly blew out his right eye and left him half blind for the last 60 years of his life. After the incident, Bunsen put arsenic aside and indulged his passion for natural explosions. Bunsen loved anything that spewed from the ground, and for several years he investigated geysers and volcanoes by hand-collecting their vapors and boiling liquids. He also jury-rigged a faux Old Faithful in his laboratory and discovered how geysers build up pressure and blow. Bunsen settled back into chemistry at the University of Heidelberg in the 1850s and soon ensured himself scientific immortality by inventing the spectroscope, which uses light to study elements. Each element on the periodic table produces sharp, narrow bands of colored light when heated. Hydrogen, for example, always emits one red, one yellowish-green, one baby blue, and one indigo band. If you heat some mystery substance and it emits those specific lines, you can bet it contains hydrogen. This was a powerful breakthrough, the first way to peer inside exotic compounds without boiling them down or disintegrating them with acid. To build the first spectroscope, Bunsen and a student mounted a prism inside a discarded cigar box to keep out stray light and attached two broken-off eyepieces from telescopes to peer inside, like a diorama. The only thing limiting spectroscopy at that point was getting flames hot enough to excite elements. So Bunsen duly invented the device that made him a hero to everyone who ever melted a ruler or started a pencil on fire. He took a local technician's primitive gas burner and added a valve to adjust the oxygen flow. If you remember fussing around with the knob on the bottom of your Bunsen burner, that's it. As a result, the burner's flame improved from an inefficient, crackling orange to the tidy, hissing blue you see on good stoves today. Bunsen's work helped the periodic table develop rapidly. Although he opposed the idea of classifying elements by their spectra, other scientists had fewer qualms, and the spectroscope immediately began identifying new elements. Just as important, it helped sort through spurious claims by finding old elements in disguise in unknown substances. Reliable identification got chemists a long way toward the ultimate goal of understanding matter on a deeper level. Still, beyond finding new elements, scientists needed to organize them into a family tree of some sort. And here we come to Bunsen's other great contribution to the table, his help in building an intellectual dynasty in science at Heidelberg, where he instructed a number of people responsible for early work in periodic law. This includes our second character, Dmitri Mendeleev, the man generally acclaimed for creating the first periodic table. Truth be told, like Bunsen and the burner, Mendeleev didn't conjure up the first periodic table on his own. Six people invented it independently, and all of them built on the chemical affinities noted by an earlier generation of chemists. Mendeleev started with a rough idea of how to group elements into small synonymous sets, then transformed these gestures at a periodic system into scientific law, much like Homer transformed disconnected Greek myths into the Odyssey. Science needs heroes as much as any other field, and Mendeleev became the protagonist of the story of the periodic table for a number of reasons. For one, he had a hell of a biography. Born in Siberia, the youngest of 14 children, Mendeleev lost his father in 1847 when the boy was 13. Boldly, for the time, his mother took over a local glass factory to support the family and managed the male craftsmen working there. Then the factory burned down. Pinning her hopes on her sharp-minded son, she bundled him up on horseback and rode 1,200 miles across the steppes and steep, snowy Ural Mountains to an elite university in Moscow, which rejected Dmitri because he wasn't local stock. Undaunted, Mama Mendeleev bundled him back up and rode 400 miles farther to his dead father's alma mater in St. Petersburg. Just after seeing him enrolled, she died. Mendeleev proved to be a brilliant student. After graduation, he studied in Paris and Heidelberg, where the eminent Bunsen supervised him for a spell. The two clashed, personally, partly because Mendeleev was moody and partly because of Bunsen's notoriously loud and foul-fumed lab. Mendeleev returned to St. Petersburg as a professor in the 1860s, and there began to think about the nature of elements, work that culminated in his famous periodic table of 1869. Many others were working on the problem of how to organize elements, and some even solved it, however haltingly, with the same approach as Mendeleev. In England, a 30-something chemist named John Newlands presented his makeshift table to a chemistry society in 1865, but a rhetorical blunder doomed Newlands. At the time, no one knew about the noble gases, helium through radon, so the top rows of his periodic table contained only 7 units. Newlands whimsically compared the 7 columns to the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do of the musical scale. Unfortunately, the Chemical Society of London was not the most whimsical audience, and they ridiculed Newlands' Nickelodeon chemistry. The more serious rival to Mendeleev was Julius Lothar Meyer, a German chemist with an unruly white beard and neatly oiled black hair. Meyer had also worked under Bunsen at Heidelberg and had serious professional credentials. Among other things, he'd figured out that red blood cells transport oxygen by binding it to hemoglobin. Meyer published his table at practically the same time as Mendeleev, and the two even split a prestigious pre-Nobel Prize called the Davy Medal in 1882 for co-discovering the periodic law. It was an English prize, but Newlands was shut out until 1887 when he earned his own Davy Medal. While Meyer continued to do great work that added to his reputation, he helped popularize a number of radical theories that turned out correct, Mendeleev turned cranky, a queer fish who incredibly refused to believe in the reality of atoms. He would later also reject other things he couldn't see, such as electrons and radioactivity. Author's note: it might seem incredible to us today that Mendeleev refused to believe in atoms, but this was a not uncommon view among chemists at the time. They refused to believe in anything they couldn't see with their own eyes, and they treated atoms as abstractions. A handy way of doing the accounting, maybe, but surely fictitious. If you had sized up the two men around 1880 and judged which was the greater theoretical chemist, you might have picked Meyer. So what separated Mendeleev from Meyer and the other four chemists who published tables before them, at least in history's judgment? Author's note: the best description of the six scientists competing to form the first systematic arrangement of elements can be found in Eric Sherry's The Periodic Table. Three other people are generally given credit for co-inventing, or at least contributing to, the periodic system. Alexandre-Émile Béguier de Champcourtois, according to Sherry, discovered the single most important step in developing the periodic table: that the properties of the elements are a periodic function of their atomic weights. A full 7 years before Mendeleev arrived at the same conclusion, de Champcourtois, a geologist, drew his periodic system on a spiral cylinder like the thread of a screw. The possibility of his getting credit for the table was dashed when a publisher couldn't figure out how to reproduce the crucial screw diagram showing all the elements. The publisher finally threw his hands up and printed the paper without it. Imagine trying to learn about the periodic table without being able to see it. Nonetheless, de Champcourtois' cause as founder of the periodic system was taken up by his fellow Frenchman Lecoq de Bois-Baudrin, perhaps partly to get Mendeleev's goat. William Odling, an accomplished English chemist, seems to have been a victim of bad luck. He got many things right about the periodic table, but is virtually forgotten today. Perhaps with his many other chemical and administrative interests, he simply got outworked by Mendeleev, who obsessed over the table. One thing Odling got wrong was the length of the periods of the elements, the number of elements that have to appear before similar traits reappear. He assumed all the periods were of length 8, but that's true only at the top of the table. Because of D shells, rows 3 and 4 require a period of 18 elements. Because of F shells, rows 5 and 6 require 32. Gustavus Hinrichs was the only American on the list of co-discoverers, although he was not native-born, and the only one described as both a crank and a maverick genius ahead of his time. He published over 3,000 scientific articles in 4 languages and pioneered the study and classification of elements with the light emissions that Bunsen discovered. He also played with numerology and developed a spiral arm periodic table that placed many really tough elements in the correct groups. As Sherry sums him up, the work of Hinrichs is so idiosyncratic and labyrinthine that a more complete study will be required before anyone can venture to pronounce on its real value. First, more than any other chemist, Mendeleev understood that certain traits about elements persist, even if others don't. He realized a compound like mercuric oxide, an orange solid, doesn't somehow contain a gas, oxygen, and a liquid metal, mercury, as others believed. Rather, mercuric oxide contains 2 elements that happen to form a gas and a metal when separate. What stays constant is each element's atomic weight, which Mendeleev considered its defining trait, very close to the modern view. Second, unlike others who had dabbled in arranging elements into columns and rows, Mendeleev had worked in chemistry labs his whole life and had acquired a deep, deep knowledge of how elements felt and smelled and reacted, especially metals, the most ambiguous and naughty elements to place on the table. This allowed him to incorporate all 62 known elements into his columns and rows. Mendeleev also revised his table obsessively, at one point writing elements on index cards and playing a sort of chemical solitaire in his office. Most important of all, while both Mendeleev and Meyer left gaps on their table where no known elements fit, Mendeleev, unlike the squeamish Meyer, had balls enough to predict that new elements would be dug up. "Look harder, you chemists and geologists," he seemed to taunt, "and you'll find them." By tracing the traits of known elements down each column, Mendeleev even predicted the densities and atomic weights of hidden elements. And when some predictions proved correct, people were mesmerized. Furthermore, when scientists discovered noble gases in the 1890s, Mendeleev's table passed a crucial test, since it easily incorporated the gases by adding one new column. Mendeleev denied that noble gases existed at first, but by then the periodic table was no longer just his. Then there was Mendeleev's outsized character. Like his Russian contemporary Dostoevsky, who wrote his entire novel The Gambler in 3 weeks to pay off desperate gambling debts, Mendeleev threw together his first table to meet a textbook publisher's deadline. He'd already written volume one of the textbook, a 500-page tome, but it got through just 8 elements. That meant he had to fit all the rest into volume two. After 6 weeks of procrastinating, he decided in one inspired moment that the most concise way to present the information was in a table. Excited, he blew off his side job as a chemistry consultant for local cheese factories to compile the table. When the book appeared in print, Mendeleev not only predicted that new elements would fit into empty boxes beneath the likes of silicon and boron, but he also provisionally named them. It couldn't have hurt his reputation. People seek gurus during uncertain times, that he used an exotic, mystical language to create those names, using the Sanskrit word for beyond, eka silicon, eka boron, and so on. A few years later, Mendeleev, now famous, divorced his wife and wanted to remarry. Although the conservative local church said he had to wait 7 years, he bribed a priest and got on with the nuptials. This technically made him a bigamist, but no one dared arrest him. When a local bureaucrat complained to the Tsar about the double standard applied to the case, the priest was defrocked. The Tsar primly replied, "I admit, Mendeleev has 2 wives, but I have only 1 Mendeleev." Still, the Tsar's patience wasn't infinite. In 1890, Mendeleev, a self-professed anarchist, was booted out of his academic post for sympathizing with violent leftist student groups. It's easy to see why historians and scientists grew attached to Mendeleev's life's tale. Of course, no one would remember his biography today had he not constructed his periodic table. Overall, Mendeleev's work is comparable to that of Darwin in evolution and Einstein in relativity. None of these men did all the work, but they did the most work, and they did it more elegantly than others. They saw how far the consequences extended, and they backed up their findings with reams of evidence. And like Darwin, Mendeleev made lasting enemies for his work. Naming elements he'd never seen was presumptuous, and doing so infuriated the intellectual successor of Robert Bunsen, the man who discovered eka aluminium, and justifiably felt that he, not the rabid Russian, deserved credit and naming rights. The discovery of eka aluminium, now known as gallium, raises the question of what really drives science forward. Theories, which frame how people view the world, or experiments, the simplest of which can destroy elegant theories. After a dust-up with the theorist Mendeleev, the experimentalist who discovered gallium had a definite answer. Paul-Émile François Lecoq de Bois-Baudrin was born into a winemaking family in the Cognac region of France in 1838. Handsome, with sinuous hair and a curled mustache, prone to wearing stylish cravats, he moved to Paris as an adult, mastered Bunsen's spectroscope, and became the best spectroscopic surgeon in the world. Lecoq de Bois-Baudrin grew so adroit that in 1875, after spotting never-before-seen color bends in a mineral, he concluded, instantly and correctly, he'd discovered a new element. He named it gallium after Gallia, the Latin name for France. Conspiracy mongers accuse him of slyly naming the element after himself, since Lecoq, or the rooster, is Gallus in Latin. Lecoq de Bois-Baudrin decided he wanted to hold and feel his new prize, so he set about purifying a sample of it. It took a few years, but by 1878 the Frenchman finally had a nice, pure hunk of gallium. Though solid at moderate room temperature, gallium melts at 84 degrees Fahrenheit, meaning that if you hold it in the palm of your hand, because body temperature is about 98 degrees Fahrenheit, It will melt into a grainy, thick puddle of pseudo-quicksilver. It's one of the few liquid metals you can touch without boiling your finger to the bone. As a result, gallium has been a staple of practical jokes among the chemistry cognoscenti ever since, a definite step up from Bunsen burner humor. One popular trick, since gallium molds easily and looks like aluminium, is to fashion gallium spoons, serve them with tea, and watch as your guests recoil when their Earl Grey eats their utensils. Author's note, if you're dying to see the gallium practical joke in action, you can see a spoon of gallium melting into nothing on YouTube. Oliver Sacks also talks about pulling pranks of this sort in Uncle Tungsten, a memoir of his boyhood. Lecoq de Boisbaudrin reported his findings in scientific journals, rightfully proud of his capricious medal. Gallium was the first new element discovered since Mendeleev's 1869 table, and when the theorist Mendeleev read about Lecoq de Boisbaudrin's work, he tried to cut in line and claim credit for gallium based on his prediction of eca aluminium. Lecoq de Boisbaudrin responded tersely that no, he had done the real work. Mendeleev demurred, and the Frenchman and the Russian began debating the matter in scientific journals, like a serialized novel with different characters narrating each chapter. Before long, the discussion turned acrimonious. Annoyed at Mendeleev's crowing, Lecoq de Boisbaudrin claimed an obscure Frenchman had developed the periodic table before Mendeleev, and that the Russian had usurped this man's ideas, a scientific sin second only to forging data. Mendeleev was never so good about sharing credit. Meyer, in contrast, cited Mendeleev's table in his own work in the 1870s, which may have made it seem to later generations that Meyer's work was derivative. For his part, Mendeleev scanned Lecoq de Boisbaudrin's data on gallium and told the experimentalist, with no justification, that he must have measured something wrong, because the density and weight of gallium differed from Mendeleev's predictions. This displays a flabbergasting amount of gall, but as science philosopher-historian Eric Sherry put it, Mendeleev always was willing to bend nature to fit his grand philosophical scheme. The only difference between Mendeleev and crack pottery is that Mendeleev was right. Lecoq de Boisbaudrin soon retracted his data and published results that corroborated Mendeleev's predictions. According to Sherry, the scientific world was astounded to note that Mendeleev, the theorist, had seen the properties of a new element more clearly than the chemist who had discovered it. A literature teacher once told me that what makes a story great, and the construction of the periodic table is a great story, is a climax that's surprising yet inevitable. I suspect that upon discovering his grand scheme of the periodic table, Mendeleev felt astonished, yet also convinced of its truth, because of its elegant, inescapable simplicity. No wonder he sometimes grew intoxicated at the power he felt. Leaving aside scientific machismo, the real debate here centered on theory versus experiment. Had theory tuned Lecoq de Boisbaudrin's senses to help him see something new? Or had experiment provided the real evidence and Mendeleev's theory just happened to fit? Mendeleev might as well have predicted cheese on Mars before Lecoq de Boisbaudrin found evidence for his table in gallium. Then again, the Frenchman had to retract his data and issue new results that supported what Mendeleev had predicted. Although Lecoq de Boisbaudrin denied he had ever seen Mendeleev's table, it's possible he had heard of others, or that the tables had gotten the scientific community talking and had indirectly primed scientists to keep an eye peeled for new elements. As no less a genius than Albert Einstein once said, it is theory that decides what we can observe. In the end, it's probably impossible to tease out whether the heads or tails of science, the theory or the experiment, has done more to push science ahead. That's especially true when you consider that Mendeleev made many wrong predictions. He was lucky, really, that a good scientist like Lecoq de Boisbaudrin discovered eca aluminium first. If someone had poked around for one of his mistakes, Mendeleev predicted there were many elements before hydrogen and swore the sun's halo contained a unique element called coronium, the Russian might have died in obscurity. But just as people forgave ancient astrologers who spun false, even contradictory horoscopes, and fixated instead on the one brilliant comet they predicted exactly, people tend to remember only Mendeleev's triumphs. Moreover, when simplifying history, it's tempting to give Mendeleev, as well as Meyer and others, too much credit. They did the important work in building the trellis on which to nail the elements. But by 1869, only two-thirds of all elements had been discovered, and for years, some of them sat in the wrong columns and rows on even the best tables. Loads of work separates a modern textbook from Mendeleev, especially regarding the mess of elements now quarantined at the bottom of the table, the lanthanides. The lanthanides start with lanthanum, element 57, and their proper home on the table baffled and bedeviled chemists well into the 20th century. Their buried electrons caused the lanthanides to clump together in frustrating ways. Sorting them out was like unknotting kudzu or ivy. Spectroscopy also stumbled with lanthanides, since even if scientists detected dozens of new bands of color, they had no idea how many new elements that translated to. Even Mendeleev, who wasn't shy about predictions, decided the lanthanides were too vexed to make guesses about. Few elements beyond cerium, the second lanthanide, were known in 1869. But instead of chiseling in more ekas, Mendeleev admitted his helplessness. After cerium, he dotted his table with row after row of frustrating blanks. And later, while filling in new lanthanides after cerium, he often bungled their placement, partly because many new elements turned out to be combinations of known ones. It's as if cerium was the edge of the known world to Mendeleev's circle, just like Gibraltar was to ancient mariners. And after cerium, they risked falling into a whirlpool or draining off the edge of the earth. In truth, Mendeleev could have resolved all his frustrations had he traveled just a few hundred miles west from St. Petersburg. There, in Sweden, near where cerium was first discovered, he would have come across a nondescript porcelain mine in a hamlet with the funny name of Itterby. In 1701, a braggadocian teenager named Johann Friedrich Baedeker, ecstatic at the crowd he'd rallied with a few white lies, pulled out two silver coins for a magic show. After he waved his hands and performed chemical voodoo on them, the silver pieces disappeared and a single gold piece materialized in their place. It was the most convincing display of alchemy the locals had ever seen. Baedeker thought his reputation was set, and unfortunately it was. Rumors about Baedeker inevitably reached the king of Poland, Augustus the Strong, who arrested the young alchemist and locked him, Rumpelstiltskin-like, in a castle to spin gold for the king's realm. Obviously, Baedeker couldn't deliver on this demand, and after a few futile experiments, this harmless liar, still quite young, found himself a candidate for hanging. Desperate to save his neck, Baedeker begged the king to spare him. Although he'd failed with alchemy, he claimed he knew how to make porcelain. At the time, this claim was scarcely more credible. Ever since Marco Polo had returned from China at the end of the 13th century, the European gentry had obsessed over white Chinese porcelain, which was hard enough to resist scratching with a nail file, yet miraculously translucent like an eggshell. Empires were judged by their tea sets, and wild rumors spread about porcelain's power. One rumor held that you couldn't get poisoned while drinking from a porcelain cup. Another claimed the Chinese were so fabulously wealthy in porcelain that they had erected a 9-story tower of it just to show off. That one turned out to be true. For centuries, powerful Europeans like the Medici in Florence had sponsored porcelain research, but had succeeded in producing only C-minus knockoffs. Luckily for Baedeker, King Augustus had a capable man working on porcelain, Ehrenfried Wolter von Czernhaus. Czernhaus, whose previous job was to sample the Polish soil to figure out where to dig for crown jewels, had just invented a special oven that reached 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This allowed him to melt down porcelain to analyze it, and when the king ordered the clever Baedeker to become Czernhaus's assistant, the research took off. The duo discovered that the secret ingredients in Chinese porcelain were a white clay called kaolin and a feldspar rock that fuses into glass at high temperatures. Just as crucially, they figured out that, unlike with most crockery, they had to cook the porcelain glaze and clay simultaneously, not in separate steps. It's this high-heat fusion of glaze and clay that gives true porcelain its lucidity and toughness. After perfecting the process, they returned, relieved, to show their liege. Augustus thanked them profusely, dreaming that porcelain would immediately make him, at least socially, the most influential monarch in Europe. And after such a breakthrough, Baedeker reasonably expected his freedom. Unfortunately, the king decided he was now too valuable to release and locked him up under tighter security. Inevitably, the secret of porcelain leaked, and Baedeker and Schoenhaus's recipe spread throughout Europe. With the basic chemistry in place, craftsmen tinkered with and improved the process over the next half century. Soon, wherever people found feldspar, they mined it, including in frosty Scandinavia, where porcelain stoves were prized because they reached higher temperatures and held heat longer than iron-belly stoves. To feed the burgeoning industry in Europe, a feldspar mine opened a dozen miles from Stockholm, on the Isle of Itterby, in 1780. Itterby, meaning outer village, looks exactly like you'd hope a coastal village in Sweden would, with red-roofed houses right on the water, big white shutters, and lots of fir trees in roomy yards. People travel around the archipelago in ferries. Streets are named for minerals and elements. Author's note, for some of the descriptions of the history and geology of Itterby, and for details about the town today, I consulted Jim Marshall, a chemist and historian at the University of North Texas, who was extremely generous with his time and help. He also sent me wonderful pictures. Jim is currently on a quest to revisit the spot where every element was first discovered, which is why he traveled to Itterby. Easy pickings. Good luck, Jim. The Itterby quarry was scooped from the top of a hill in the southeast corner of the island, and it supplied fine raw ore for porcelain and other purposes. More intriguingly for scientists, its rocks also produced exotic pigments and colored glazes when processed. Nowadays, we know that bright colors are dead giveaways of lanthanides, and the mine in Itterby was unusually rich in them for a few geological reasons. The Earth's elements were once mixed uniformly in the crust, as if someone had dumped a whole rack of spices into a bowl and stirred it. But metal atoms, especially lanthanides, tend to move in herds, and as the molten earth churned, they clumped together. Pockets of lanthanides happened to end up near, actually beneath, Sweden. And because Scandinavia lies near a fault line, tectonic plate action in the remote past plowed the lanthanide-rich rocks up from deep underground, a process aided by Bunsen's beloved hydrothermal vents. Finally, during the last ice age, extensive Scandinavian glaciers shaved off the surface of the land. This final geological event exposed the lanthanide-rich rock for easy mining near Itterby. But if Itterby had the proper economic conditions to make mining profitable and the proper geology to make it scientifically worthwhile, it still needed the proper social climate. Scandinavia had barely evolved beyond a Viking mentality by the late 1600s, a century during which even its universities held witch hunts and sorcerer hunts for male witches on a scale that would have embarrassed Salem. But in the 1700s, after Sweden conquered the peninsulas politically and the Swedish Enlightenment conquered it culturally, Scandinavians embraced rationalism en masse. Great scientists started popping up all out of proportion to the region's small population. This included Johan Gatelin, born in 1760, a chemist in a line of scientific-minded academics. His father occupied a joint professorship in physics and theology, while his grandfather held the even more unlikely posts of physics professor and bishop. After extensive travel in Europe as a young man, including in England, where he befriended and toured the clay mines of porcelain maker Josiah Wedgwood, Gatelin settled down in Turku, in what is now Finland, across the Baltic Sea from Stockholm. There he earned a reputation as a geochemist. Amateur geologists began shipping unusual rocks from Itterby to him to get his opinion, and little by little, through Gatelin's publications, The scientific world began to hear about this remarkable little quarry. Even though he didn't have the chemical tools or chemical theory to tweeze out all 14 lanthanides, Gadolin made significant progress in isolating clusters of them. He made element hunting a pastime, even an avocation. And when, in Mendeleev's old age, chemists with better tools revisited Gadolin's work on the Iterbe rocks, new elements started to fall out like loose change. Gadolin had started a trend by naming one supposed element yttria, and in homage to all the elements' common origin, chemists began to immortalize Iterbe on the periodic table. More elements, 7, trace their lineage back to Iterbe than to any other person, place, or thing. It was the inspiration for ytterbium, yttrium, terbium, and erbium. For the other 3 unnamed elements, before running out of letters, erbium doesn't quite look right. Chemists adopted holmium after Stockholm, thulium after the mythic name for Scandinavia, and at Lecoq de Boisbaudrin's insistence, Gadolin's namesake, gadolinium. Overall, of the 7 elements discovered in Iterbe, 6 were Mendeleev's missing lanthanides. History might have been very different. Mendeleev reworked his table incessantly and might have filled in the entire lower realm of the table after cerium by himself, if only he'd made the trip west, across the Gulf of Finland and the Baltic Sea, to this Galapagos island of the periodic table.